show. I have to ask permission to do certain things, you know. So the question is I'm really free? The United States Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional to sentence a juvenile to a mandatory life sentence. Shouldn't it be unconstitutional to have that same juvenile on lifetime parole? You know, I think dumb issues still needs to be addressed, and they're not being addressed in the United States. We still have tons of juveniles in the penal system that needs to have the same opportunities that I'm having. And the high points for me is that I'm able to tell my story and share the stories of other juvenile lifers that were left behind. Because I still feel when I left in 2017 that I was leaving the only family that I knew for 30-something years. You know, and it gets lonely out here. It gets real lonely. It gets depressing, you know. And if we don't have that support team to help us get through that day, you know, that's when we see the recidivism rate go up. Because I'm telling you, from personal experience, there's been days when I wish I was back.
Well, we need a part two, leaving it there. Luis David Suave Gonzalez, thanks so much for being with us, subject of the new podcast Suave by Futuro Media and PRX. And thanks so much, Maria Hinojosa, executive producer of Suave and anchor and executive producer of the Peabody Award-winning show Latino USA. That does it for our show. Happy birthday,
You're
Julia Thomas.
I'm listener-supported community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Police Association President Brian Hunziker abruptly resigned yesterday. A federal judge has ordered sanctions on the Portland Police Bureau, which continues to abuse its stock of so-called less lethal weapons, and the man who went on a shooting spree in Georgia yesterday has been charged with 8 counts of murder. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 17th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon Health Authority reported 239 new confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19 on Wednesday, bringing the total number of cases in the state to 160,259. There are 3 new coronavirus-related deaths in Oregon, raising the state's death toll from the disease to 2,349. There are currently 119 people hospitalized statewide, including 23 patients in intensive care units. So far, more than 1.3 million first and second doses of a COVID-19 vaccine have been administered statewide. A spokesperson for the Oregon Health Authority said on Wednesday that all adults in the state will be eligible to receive the vaccine by May 1st. That doesn't mean everyone will be vaccinated by May 1st, just that all adults will be eligible. Governor Brown has said she will consider accelerating the vaccine timeline as long as the state receives enough doses from the federal government. The most recent plan indicates a new group will become eligible on March 29th. That group includes adults aged 45 to 64, migrant, seasonal, farm, and other agricultural workers, food processing workers, people experiencing houselessness, people living in low-income senior housing, people displaced by wildfires, wildfire fighters, and pregnant people 16 and older. Nationally, the United States has reported more than 29.6 million cases of COVID-19. at least 537,000 people have died across the country. Daily death reports around the country have fallen steadily from their peak earlier this year, but thousands of people continue to die from the virus each week. More than 22% of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, with 12% of the population fully vaccinated. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened over 121 million people in nearly every country. At least 2.6 million people have died. The Portland Police Association president, Brian Hunziker, has resigned after 5 months on the job. The reason remains unclear, but according to a press release from the Police Association, it has something to do with the misinformation surrounding an alleged hit-and-run connected to Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. That crime did happen, but Hardesty was nowhere near the crime scene or the vehicles involved. The PPA press release read, quote, "Over the last 24 hours, we learned that PPA President Brian Hunziker made a serious, isolated mistake related to the police bureau's investigation into the alleged hit-and-run by Commissioner Hardesty." The release went on, quote, "Brian's mistake was not driven by malice, but it was a serious mistake. He has held himself to account by resigning his position as PPA president effective immediately." The vague press release does not indicate what mistake was made, but it likely has to do with the sharing of information about the hit-and-run with the right-wing group called Coalition to Save Portland. After Hardesty was cleared as a suspect in the March 3rd hit-and-run, Mayor and Police Commissioner Ted Wheeler called for an independent investigation into how the mistake was leaked by PPB to the Coalition. Hunziker replied to Wheeler's call for an investigation on Facebook, saying, quote, "It's unconscionable for the mayor to prioritize a case of mistaken identity over the legitimate community concerns like nightly shootings, violence, arson, and vandalism." Hunziker also accused Hardesty of spreading her own misinformation during an incident in 2020 when Hardesty accused PPB officers of setting fire to their own buildings. Hardesty later apologized for her statements. The Coalition to Save Portland claims it received information about the hit-and-run from a PPB officer, but it declined to name who. The Coalition is supportive of the PPA, police officers, and is friendly with former PPA President Daryl Turner, who will be taking the helm as the president of the police union until this fall. Hunziker's resignation from the PPA will not impact his role as a police officer. Wheeler called for more answers on Tuesday, saying, quote, "His resignation raises significant questions that remain unanswered. I demand to know what the mistake was." A federal judge on Tuesday ordered sanctions against the Portland Police Bureau. The order will require the Bureau to train officers in how to use crowd control devices by the end of the year. The order also requires the city to investigate numerous allegations of misconduct against police officer Brent Taylor, who was often part of the rapid response team during racial justice protests last year. U.S. District Court Chief Judge Marco Hernandez said in his ruling that the sanctions are to stay in place until the city of Portland, quote, "demonstrates to the court that it will comply with the court's order." The ruling comes after local civil rights organization Don't Shoot Portland filed a lawsuit in June against the city for its indiscriminate use of tear gas during the nightly protests. Shortly thereafter, a judge issued a temporary restraining order requiring police to limit the use of chemical weapons to situations where, quote, "the lives or safety of the public or police are at risk." In late November, Judge Hernandez found the city in contempt of his order, stating that officers violated the terms of the order during a June 30th protest outside the Portland Police Association headquarters in North Portland. Two of the incidents involved Officer Brent Taylor, who deployed 15 rounds from his so-called less lethal rifle during struggles over a banner that protesters were carrying. Until the investigation into Taylor's actions is complete, he will not be allowed to work at protest events. In addition to not being able to use certain weapons, such as a so-called less lethal grenade launcher, the rapid response team will have to promptly report when they discharge their weapons. Civil rights attorney Juan Chavez welcomed the ruling, saying, quote, "We hope the city sees this as an opportunity to move forward towards the kind of transformational change that Portlanders have been demanding for years. It took the voices of thousands in the streets to bring about a temporary end to this kind of wanton police violence. Black Lives Matter." A Portland police commander was caught on video at a neighborhood meeting in Lentz telling residents of the area if they want to reduce crime, they should vote out District Attorney Mike Schmidt. East Precinct Commander Erica Hurley attended the January 14th meeting of an anti-crime neighborhood group in Southeast Portland. She attended during work hours and on behalf of the Portland Police Bureau in full police uniform with her service weapon. Hurley told meeting attendees that the recent drug decriminalization bill is making it harder for them to make drug arrests for possession. Measure 110, which decriminalizes possession of small amounts of drugs, was passed in November with over 58% of the vote statewide. She suggested to the group that in order to make more arrests on drug-related offenses, they would need to unseat newly and overwhelmingly elected District Attorney Mike Schmidt. She also encouraged the neighbors to demand more money for the police bureau and warned if they didn't, neighborhood response teams, the groups that police houseless encampments, might be the next to get cut. Video of Hurley's comments was posted on YouTube by the Lentz Neighborhood Livability Association, the group she visited with, and could lead to disciplinary action by the police bureau. Bureau Directive 313.20 prohibits officers from using their, quote, official authority or influence while engaging in political activity. A Portland civil rights lawyer who spoke to Willamette Week about the incident said, quote, "A uniform is, you are literally cloaked in the authority of the state or city. Those statements are deeply concerning, and they sound very much like she is encouraging people to vote against the district attorney when he comes up for election." On Tuesday, a man went on a shooting spree at three spas in the state of Georgia, killing eight people, seven of whom were women. 21-year-old white man Robert Aaron Long was charged on Wednesday with eight counts of murder and one count of aggravated assault. The shootings took the lives of six women of Asian descent. Long claims he had a, quote, "sexual addiction" and had carried out the murders in the spas in order to assuage his, quote, "temptation." He said he had frequented the spas in the past and chose to attack them as a form of vengeance. Gender and race-related hate crimes are on the rise in the United States. Asian Americans have been targeted in nearly 4,000 hate incidents in the past year. Organizations that study hate groups warn of a phenomenon called, quote, "male supremacy terror," driven by male entitlement and a desire to preserve traditional gender roles. The Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League are focusing on the intersection of white supremacy with misogyny, a hatred of women, that appears to drive many of these mass shootings perpetrated by white men. Two jurors in the murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin have been dismissed by the judge. The jurors were dismissed because they said they couldn't be impartial because of a $27 million civil settlement reached last week between Minneapolis and George Floyd's family. Derek Chauvin is on trial for the murder of George Floyd, which prompted worldwide racial justice protests last June. For more, we go to Georgia Fort from the Racial Reckoning Project.
During pretrial hearings Tuesday in the Derek Chauvin trial, defense attorneys pushed to include evidence about a previous police encounter with George Floyd.
The entire arrest in May of 2019 is remarkably similar. He starts saying some of the exact same things, including calling out for his mama. He claims to have been shot, and he begins, you know, this crying kind of erratic behavior.
The defense argued that in May 2019, George Floyd ingested drugs to avoid being arrested, while the prosecution argued the incident in 2019 had nothing to do with the way Derek Chauvin treated George Floyd. The state requested the 2019 arrest not be included as evidence.
The desperation of the defense to just smear Mr. Floyd's character by showing that, you know, what he struggled with, an opioid addiction like so many Americans do.
Judge Cahill did not make a decision on the matter Tuesday afternoon, as he told the court he could see the merit of both the prosecution and defense's argument. Eliza Darius, executive director of the Freedom Fund, watches the trial closely. He says the defense should focus on defending the actions of their client, not prosecuting the character of George Floyd.
The only reason why the defense team would even possibly consider utilizing that type of evidence is to dehumanize George Floyd, is to turn him into something that should be sneered at.
The judge took the motion to exclude the evidence under advisement and is expected to make a ruling Wednesday. He's also still considering a change of venue after the defense claimed Friday's civil settlement tainted the jury pool. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Georgia Fort.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on foster care in the pandemic. At 6, it's Rural Roots Rising. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, stick around for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be mostly cloudy with a low of 40. Tomorrow we can expect rain and a high of 54. Today in history, in 1912, activist Bayard Rustin was born. Rustin was a leader in the fight for civil rights and gay rights throughout the 20th century. He was the chief organizer of the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Rustin's personal philosophy was inspired by combining Quaker pacifism with socialism, as well as a deep focus on Gandhi's commitment to nonviolent protest. The quote of the day is from Rustin, who said, quote, "When an individual is protesting society's refusal to acknowledge his dignity as a human being, his very act of protest confers dignity on him." New details are emerging that connect Russia and rampant misinformation to the 2020 election. With more on that story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The threat in the information domain is here to stay.
Speaking before a U.S. House panel, Defense Intelligence Officer James Sullivan said Russia is the country's biggest information warfare threat, followed by China.
Russia is, without question, ahead because they're a lot more prolific and they're a lot more destructive. They're much more aggressive in terms of trying to undermine U.S. democracy.
The hearing was held as a declassified report revealed that both Russia and Iran attempted to interfere with the 2020 presidential election. But it also said no evidence was found that foreign actors succeeded in disrupting voting. The report says Russia tried to promote then-President Donald Trump and erode trust in the election, while Iran wanted to undercut Trump and stoke societal tensions. In the Senate on Tuesday, the fight over the filibuster was front and center. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell warned that ending the procedure would not fast-track the Democrats' agenda, but instead bring work to a screeching halt.
Nobody serving in this chamber can even begin to imagine what a completely scorched earth Senate would look like.
Majority Whip Dick Durbin pushed back, calling out what he called McConnell's abuse of the filibuster.
I support discussing any proposal that ends the misuse of a filibuster as a weapon of mass destruction. If the Senate retains the filibuster, we must change the rules so that any senator who wants to bring the government to a standstill endures at least some discomfort in the process.
Supporters argue the filibuster encourages bipartisan compromise. A confirmation hearing was held for Deputy Labor Secretary nominee Julie Sue, who's currently California's Secretary of Labor and Workforce. Sue highlighted her dedication to the struggles of low-wage workers.
It is possible that we can not only ensure that their earned wages make it into their pockets, we can also build their faith in the very idea of government itself.
Also on Tuesday, the Senate confirmed Isabel Guzman to head the Small Business Administration. She held roles in the SBA for President Barack Obama. The Biden administration's Help Us Here tour continues. President Joe Biden visited a Pennsylvania flooring company to promote the American Rescue Plan, and Vice President Kamala Harris met with small business owners and local leaders in Denver.
It has been our governors, it has been our mayors, it has been the folks on the ground who've been carrying an extraordinary weight of responsibility to meet the needs of the people and be the voice of the people so that they're heard.
Biden's first formal press conference is slated for a week from Thursday, 2 months after taking office. The White House has taken some heat for not holding one sooner. And former President Trump returned to network TV for the first time since leaving office. On Fox News, Trump criticized Biden's border policies and accused the president of destroying the country. Asked about the COVID-19 vaccine, Trump said he would recommend his supporters voluntarily get the shots. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
The Internal Revenue Service is expected to extend the federal tax filing deadline until mid-May, according to reports. Lawmakers say the extension is necessary because the most recent coronavirus stimulus bill made changes to tax law. For example, the stimulus bill makes the first $10,000 collected in unemployment in 2020 tax exempt. Changes from the most recent stimulus bill and from others throughout last year have changed the tax code, and the IRS has faced pressure from taxpayers and accountants to push back the deadline. The IRS is also still facing a backlog of paper returns from last year. As of the beginning of March, the IRS still had about 6.7 million returns yet to process. Even though the federal deadline will be pushed back, the same may not apply to state tax filings. Some jobless people who have already filed their taxes may need to send in amended returns. The IRS is expected to issue official guidance in the coming days. Alaska is taking legal action to seize part of a Native allotment for a road project, and the Native allotment holder is fighting back. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The state of Alaska is taking legal action to seize part of a Native allotment for a road project. The Native allotment holder is fighting back. KYUK's Greg Kim has more.
For over 20 years, the Alaska Department of Transportation has been working on the Tundra Ridge Road project in Bethel. It wants to build a road in the 6,000-person Alaskan town that would improve access to neighborhoods for emergency vehicles. But the Polk family in Bethel stands in the state's way. The Polks own the land where the state's proposed road would pass through. The state has made offers to buy the land several times, but the Polks said the offers have been too low. The state says the offer comes from an independent appraiser who determines the fair market value. Unable to reach an agreement, the state filed action to take the land through eminent domain. Eminent domain is a process by which the government can condemn private land for public use. Warren Polk, one of the Native allotment holders, describes eminent domain a different way.
It's stealing. And that's what it is. You can call it eminent domain you want, but it's stealing the land from the landowners.
If the state condemns a property through eminent domain, the Polks would be compensated by the amount that the state most recently offered and the Polk said was too low. On March 9th, the City Council in Bethel passed a resolution opposing the state's plan to take the Polks' land by eminent domain. Bethel City Manager Pete Williams says there's an alternate route for the road that wouldn't require seizing a Native allotment. Plus, he says the alternate route would better suit the city's needs.
This road that's currently proposed is going to cause a lot of problems.
Williams says the state's proposed route would funnel too many vehicles into a residential neighborhood that isn't built to handle that much traffic. And this is not the first time that the city has given the state this warning. It passed resolutions in 2016 and 2018 advising them to go with the longer alternate route. The state says the alternate route would cause more damage to wetlands and cost almost $6 million more than a route through the Polks' property. The Polks are fighting the state's claim for eminent domain in court. Their attorneys argue that the state can achieve its objectives without taking the Polks' property. They also say the state is not taking the minimum amount of land necessary and that it is not offering just compensation. The next court hearing for the state of Alaska versus the Polks has not yet been scheduled. In Bethel, I'm Greg Kim.
New Mexico Congresswoman Deb Haaland delivered her farewell speech on the House floor Tuesday ahead of her swearing in as Secretary of the Interior. Haaland thanked her colleagues, talked about her personal struggles in life as a way she connects with people, and touched on being a Native woman in Congress.
Growing up, Native women rarely held federal leadership positions, and now little girls everywhere will know that they can run for Congress and win, and that this country holds promise for everyone. In fact, it's the unique experiences and struggles that make good leaders.
Haaland highlighted some of her work over the last 2 years, including bipartisan bills on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. She thanked her supporters, expressing she thought she'd have more time in Congress, but is now called to serve in a different way. The Strong Hearts Native Helpline is launching text service beginning next week. The helpline serves those impacted by domestic, dating, and sexual violence. The text advocacy is intended to help people who are hearing impaired or unable to vocalize a call for support. The helpline is 1-844-7-NATIVE. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A healthcare coalition is backing a legislative package that will make Medicare more available to everyone in the state of California. Advocacy groups hope other states will use this as a blueprint to make healthcare more accessible across the board. Suzanne Potter with the Public News Service has the story.
The Care for All California Coalition, made up of some 60 nonprofit advocacy groups, is pressing for passage of a package of 10 proposals designed to give more people access to health care and make the system more equitable for Californians of all races. The best known is Assembly Bill 4, which would extend Medi-Cal to all income-eligible Californians, regardless of immigration status, and Senate Bill 56, which would cover undocumented seniors. Anthony Wright with the nonprofit Health Access says the bills would get a lot more people covered.
California could again cut the rate of the uninsured in half to get under 5% and near universal coverage. California can continue to lead on coverage, on holding the health industry accountable for reducing disparities and on quality and cost.
Another bill in the package, Senate Bill 644, would allow the state insurance exchange, known as Covered California, to send an email about health plans and subsidies to anyone who applies for unemployment. And Senate Bill 65 would cover doula and midwife services under Medi-Cal in an effort to reduce the number of women and babies, particularly people of color, who die in childbirth. Assemblymember Wendy Carrillo notes that during the pandemic, a lot of people suddenly lost their jobs and health insurance and couldn't qualify for Medi-Cal because they own a home, have more than one car per driver, or had a month's worth of savings in the bank.
This means that low-income and no-income Californians must pay for doctor's visits, prescription drugs, x-rays, and even surgeries and hospital stays until they are completely destitute. And then, and only then, are they allowed to get Medi-Cal.
Korea's new bill, AB 470, would eliminate the asset test for Medi-Cal eligibility. Other proposals would create a state office of healthcare affordability and strengthen oversight on consolidation in the healthcare industry, which its backers say contributes to higher costs for patients. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A 5,000-acre solar farm in Indiana will go online around the same time that the local coal plant is scheduled to close. The state is looking at this as a win for environmental groups as well as the economy. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The Schahfer coal-fired power plant in Jasper County, Indiana, is scheduled to shut down in 2 years. When it does, about 30% of the county's tax base will vanish. Kendall Culp, a Jasper County commissioner, says the closure poses difficult questions for local leaders.
What does county government look like without your largest taxpayer, and will you be able to provide the same services? Can we still provide public safety and response, good response time for emergency services and that sort of thing?
To make up for the lost tax revenue, the county is working hard to attract new businesses and encourage growth. New clean energy development should provide a boost. A solar developer and the local utility are planning to build a massive new solar farm in Jasper County called the Dunn's Bridge Solar Project. When complete, it will span about 5,000 acres. It will also include battery storage. The project is expected to be fully operational around the same time that the coal plant closes.
We're excited. It coincides very well with the shutdown of Schahfer.
So as Jasper County moves away from coal, solar can help supply both a new, clean, renewable source of electricity and tax revenue to support community services. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 17th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Althea Billings and Claire Rosciato. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, Suzanne Potter, Mary Sherman, and Georgia Fort. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth, looking at foster care in the pandemic.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Over the past year, more than 8,000 foster care children in Oregon have endured constantly adapting to new situations, from where they live to how they learn. This means struggling to learn in front of a computer for hours on end, to now, after a year of online learning, adjusting going back to school while wearing a mask, social distancing, and learning in a classroom. Many foster children already face falling into serious statistics and being one of the less than 5% who will attend college or be one of under 50% who will not graduate high school. And their chances of becoming homeless or incarcerated are significantly higher than their peers. Portland's oldest child welfare organization, Boys and Girls Aid, is working to ensure that the challenges and obstacles of learning during the pandemic do not keep foster children and youth from having all the tools and resources they need to be successful students. Today, I spoke with Boys and Girls Aid, Sue Keller, who is the program director of The Neighborhood, a program that supports foster care youth and their specific needs, such as remote learning. Here is more with my interview with Sue Keller.
What are some things that you want listeners to know about your organization and the foster care system at large right now? What can people do and what should they know about?
Well, currently our foster care system it's overloaded. The caseloads of our DHS staff are not manageable in a timely manner. We know this. The whole world knows this. Agencies like Boys and Girls Aid are here to assist with that, to be an alternative to standard foster care. And we partner with DHS, and we find them to be extremely helpful in so many ways. I was thinking about this interview and just thinking about a time over the pandemic when I had a youth who had a COVID exposure and needed to be quarantined. And unfortunately, we did not have the staff or support available to quarantine him for the full length of time. And it was really amazing that DHS was able to step up and provide a kind of a respite placement where that youth could safely go during the quarantine and enjoy his time and not feel penalized by what was going on, but rather it was more of a vacation. They had really put everything in place and worked really well with us to make sure that it was as comfortable for the youth as it possibly could be. And as you know, this is not a comfortable time, right? There's nothing comfortable about constantly jumping from home to home. And so I was just thinking of that example because this youth's DHS caseworker worked with me so quickly and so compassionately to make sure that the placement for this youth was supportive and warm and really helped, you know, my team, who was feeling awful that some of us were sick and not able to provide the care that we needed to be able to provide, and also really support that youth and give him a safe place to stay. So I think it's really important for the community to understand that there are a multitude of agencies beyond DHS that are attempting to do this work and attempting to serve children in need. And there are a multitude of ways that you can get involved, whether it be directly with DHS or with an agency such as ours. And it doesn't have to be necessarily being a foster parent, although I beg of you, if you're available to be a foster parent, you have no idea the amazing impact you will make in the life of a child. But if that is outside the means of what your family can do, there are so many other ways to get involved. And it's as easy as just contacting an agency like Boys and Girls Aid and saying, I want to help. What can I do? And they will just give you a litany of ideas.
Can you tell us what were some of the challenges that all foster children were facing working with organizations before the pandemic? And then how has the pandemic worsened or created new issues?
Well, from the perspective of just a parent who's been a foster parent, I will tell you, you know, that all foster children come in with their own trauma history, and it affects the way that they interact in a school setting. It affects their ability to learn and the support that they need. Virtual, having to switch to distance learning or virtual learning is obviously going to weigh heavily on that. Generally in school, children who have that level of need receive certain supports from paraprofessionals, and that same support is not obviously available in a distance learning setting. So I will say, from the perspective of a foster parent or even just a parent watching children in general struggle with the transition from in-person learning and being able to have immediate access to their teachers and hands-on learning experiences to something on a screen where they need to sit in place all day is very difficult. From my perspective in my program, which is the neighborhood at Boys and Girls Aid, we serve teens ages 12 to 18 of all genders throughout three different counties. And those teenagers have all been receiving some type of paraprofessional support when they are in school. They also have teams of people assisting them. They have multiple services that they receive in the community. They have flexibility of schedule. They have things like breaks throughout the day so that they can, you know, just kind of chill for a minute, regroup themselves, get ready to pay back attention, and to put them in front of a screen from, say, 9:30 to 3:30 Monday through Friday and hope that they are going to just sit there and listen to a teacher lecture with no assistance has really been a sad and disappointing struggle for these youth.
Obviously, most parents and those in your position and those who work with you, I'm sure, just want children to be able to safely go back to school in person. In the meantime, what can help these kids who are in this situation, whether they're foster care children or not, but especially foster care children, who are, like you said, struggling with so many things that they've experienced and are continuing to experience? And learning is just really difficult right now. Learning, like you said, by yourself, without any assistance through a screen.
Yeah, so for the neighborhood program specifically through Boys and Girls Aid, let me just preface by saying what this program does for foster children is, or has been prior to the pandemic, not just providing you know, support or a foster home for the youth to live in, but we also were providing day programming, which meant that if there were appointments that youth needed to get to during the day, our staff was going and getting them and taking them to those appointments. They would come to our program after school each day. We could assist them with homework. We could assist them with life skills training, social interactions, opportunities for peer development. And so every day, at least Monday through Friday, they were having access to assistance even outside of school, right? So building social skills, getting assistance with their academics, all of those things were additional benefits by being in a program such as the neighborhood. Unfortunately, when the pandemic hit, we had to weigh following all the guidelines set out by the CDC And we had to weigh that against the services that the youth needed. And we had to make a decision to close our day programming facility. And when we closed that facility, these foster parents, who frequently are two working parents, were put in a position where now they had youth who needed 24/7 sight and sound supervision in their home, who needed them to assist with virtual learning throughout the day and after school care and all of the services we provided, while at the same time trying to manage their own jobs and continue to work. And this has proved for some families to really be an impossible feat. And so what happens is the youth most frequently are the ones to lose out because they don't have the same levels of support that they had prior to the pandemic. And unfortunately, for safety, for the safety of their families, for the safety of our staff, and obviously for the safety of the clients themselves, we have had to prioritize keeping them in their homes and not exposing them to other youth for the majority of the pandemic. So as a result, the youth have really, really lost out on those supports, both academic and skill building, that they normally would have had access to. And the parents have lost out on that ability to have the time away from the youth in order to manage their own careers. So it's been a real hardship to all parties involved. And of course, you have to consider the safety of our staff in the situation where, when many people are able to work from home, a direct care staff has to be with a child at all times. And regardless of if we can keep those youth home with their foster parents, we still are required by the state to provide a certain amount of behavioral rehabilitation skills on a weekly basis. And so direct care support does still have to occur. So we had a lot of things that we had to factor in when we were considering our best practices and going forward with the pandemic. And at times, as things started to seem like they were lifting a little and we were doing better, we would have discussions on, you know, what could next steps look like? Phase one, phase two, phase three. And the agency was so diligent about making sure that they were planning in advance for this and keeping us posted and up to date. But what we finally found was just the burden of having the kids home all day, every day with no assistance was proving to be such a hardship to their academics and to their family that we were going to have to take some kind of action in order to help the youth succeed and help the parents survive this all in all. Right. So in the case of our program, we went to great lengths to develop a program. We call it pod learning. We use a space out in our Beaverton location, and it's a big office space. And in that giant office space, we can safely host about three youth and two staff at a time with social distancing and obviously following all of the CDC guidelines. And the youth can come to the program 2 days a week and get direct care and assistance all day during their classes. And that gives them also 2 days a week where the parents have free to be able to focus on their jobs. And so that's been helpful. It also allows my staff to be more engaged with what's going on with each youth, who frequently each youth goes to a different high school because they're all from different areas and different counties. So it gives the staff a chance to engage directly with the supports of the school and understand where there might be some lagging skills in academics and where we can better support them, both when they're with us and where we can advise the foster parents for the times when they're back in the home.
Absolutely. And I wanted to ask, you know, how are kids doing? How has that improved their learning? And is there anything that folks who are listening or want to, you know, encourage other folks to either donate their resources or time to help specifically with foster care children and this program?
You know, one of the things at the beginning of the pandemic that I was very grateful for was Portland State University School of Education had entered into talks with us about some of their students coming forward and offering to support youth and do some tutoring with these kids. And unfortunately, because of the pandemic restrictions, it was difficult for us to actually implement that. But I, even just today, it was brought to my attention that as the decision has been made for students to return in the end of March and early April to school, it's just going to be one more transition. And that transition is going to be difficult. So I think having mentors, having donations of resources, having people volunteer to tutor if they have any kind of academic background, all of those things can be really useful. Maybe even just transportation, people that want to be volunteers to transport kids to school, because certainly we'll have hybrid models for a while here that are going to affect, you know, the days of the week that kids go versus when their parents work. And it's going to be an interesting thing for us to navigate. And so there's many ways, I think, you know, financially, obviously, donations can contribute directly to us providing the right amount of staffing and transportation and the costs incurred there, the supplies that youth are going to need to be involved on a hybrid basis, the safety supplies around following COVID guidelines and making sure that youth have all the sanitation materials that they need in place. Schools are going to have a very high expectation for opening back up and keeping our kids safe. So I think just looking for all those opportunities to donate and assist, there's a million of them out there. And again, contact our agency if you feel like you're someone that could offer any type of assistance. And we'll get you going.
This is Claire Rosciato with KBOO News in Depth.